You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC News' London correspondent, will help us set the day's agenda. Geoffrey, what are we looking at today?
Well, yet again, we're looking at the spy scandal. Will President Obama pledge not to spy on foreign leaders?
More from Geoffrey in a moment. But plus, could the Democratic Republic of Congo finally defeat its most powerful rebel group, the M23? We'll assess the situation as renewed fighting engulfs the country.
Also ahead, we'll discuss the latest Norwegian news with our regular contributor Lars Bevanger.
And we'll also be heading to the Dutch city of Eindhoven for a chat with Rogier van der Heijder, chief design officer for Philips Lighting.
We want to be a people's company. We want to do healthcare. We want to make simple solutions that enrich your life. Or that sounds like marketing babble, but it is for real.
All of that plus Mexican horror movies. And we'll leaf through the British newspapers. We'll even play some music too. That is all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with all the latest headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The White House has acknowledged the need for greater constraints on US intelligence services following the latest claims of surveillance of its allies. President Obama has come under fierce criticism abroad over allegations that the National Security Agency tapped the mobile phone of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and conducted widespread electronic snooping in France, Italy, Spain and elsewhere. The accusations have caused tensions between the United States and some of its closest traditional allies and could threaten a US-European trade deal and transatlantic information sharing. Speaking to the new cable network Fusion, the president confirmed that a complete review of intelligence operations outside the US is underway.
They're involved in a whole wide range of issues, and we give them policy direction, but what we've seen over the last several years is their capacities continue to develop and expand, and that's why I'm initiating now a review to make sure that what they're able to do doesn't necessarily mean what they should be doing.
At least 13 people have died in a storm which has battered northwestern Europe. Six of the deaths were in Germany. Four of them happened when trees fell on cars. Four people also died in southern England. Record gusts of 119 miles an hour were recorded on the North Sea, and there was widespread travel disruption in several countries. In the UK, some 600,000 homes lost power. Chinese police have named two suspects they believe are linked to Monday's incident in which five people died when a car ploughed into a group of people in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Three people inside the car were killed, along with two tourists. A further 38 people were injured. The suspects come from Xinjiang province, which is home to a minority Muslim group, some of whose members have complained of cultural and religious repression by Beijing. There have been some outbreaks of violence in the region. James Comey has been installed as the new director of the FBI. He replaces Robert Mueller, who's led the bureau since shortly before the September 11, 2001 attacks. Comey served as Deputy U.S. Attorney General for President George W. Bush and had previously been the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. In 2004, he gained notoriety for refusing to certify the legal aspects of National Security Agency domestic surveillance during a stint as Acting Attorney General. He's promised to continue the FBI's work to protect U.S. civilians.
The FBI's reputation for integrity is a gift given to every new employee by those who went before. But it is a gift that must be protected and earned every single day. We protect that gift by making mistakes and admitting them, by making promises and keeping them, and by realizing that nothing, no case, no source, no fear of embarrassment is worth jeopardizing the gift of integrity.
Protesters have gone on the rampage in Sao Paulo after a teenager was shot dead by police on Sunday. Local stores were looted and ransacked. Traffic was blocked for hours after two trucks and at least five buses were torched on a major road. At one point, a group of protesters hijacked one of the trucks and drove it on the highway at high speeds. The demonstrators were protesting against the death of 17-year-old Douglas Rodriguez, who police said was shot in the chest accidentally on Sunday. The Chinese piano virtuoso Lang Lang has become the 12th United Nations Messenger of Peace, joining celebrities such as Stevie Wonder, Michael Douglas, Edward Norton and Charlize Theron. Messengers of Peace are celebrities mainly from the fields of film, music, literature and sport who promote UN activities and ideals through public appearances and media contacts. The announcement was made by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said that Lang will have a special focus on global education.
I know Lang Lang's message will strike a chord from symphony halls to school halls. It is with great pleasure and pride that I designate Lang Lang as a United Nations Messenger of Peace. Lang Lang, congratulations and great work for the peace of the world.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
There's an interesting list of messengers of peace there, isn't there? So Michael Douglas is one, Charlize Theron, Edward Norton, I mean...
Yo-Yo Ma?
Yeah, another, Edward Norton
of Fight Club.
That's it. I mean, Yo-Yo Ma, Lang Lang, I'm all over those. I can understand the logic there, but I'm not sure Edward Norton...
Whatever next, Bruce Willis?
Well, there we go.
Jane Goodall, 2002, messenger of peace.
Look what
she
happened
did
to
a lot of Googling straight away. Yeah, I'd be up for Bruce Willis, actually, so you can sort of sit silently and grumpily at large meetings of world leaders. Barney Burnham will be back just before 8:30. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti che.
From London,
London, cara.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London, where it is now 8:07. It's time to set the day's agenda. Jeffrey Kaufman, London's ABC London correspondent, joins us today in the studio with the three biggest stories of the day. Jeffrey, welcome to the program. Shall we begin, though, with the NSA scandal? President Obama, a man who's famously said, "The buck stops with me," a man who seemingly doesn't seem to know what's going on.
I think this is serious damage for Obama. When you think about his campaign in 2008, he ran against John McCain saying that he wanted to restore America's place in the world, that George Bush had done so much damage with the Iraq War, with his targeting of terrorism, surveillance, that he was going to change things. And I think this is very painful, not just for Obama, but for his supporters, because it's clearly an area where his presidency has failed. He didn't know they were spying on Angela Merkel. I'm not sure what's worse. Did he know and he didn't do anything about it, or he didn't know and they weren't telling him? But this is a real blow. And now mixed messages coming from the White House. In the last 24 hours, Dianne Feinstein, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying the White House has pledged they're going to stop spying on friendly foreign presidents and prime ministers. The White House then saying, well, we haven't quite said that.
I mean, I guess it raises the question of how murky forevermore the waters will be around these sorts of issues. I mean, whatever promises we get, what can be believed now that we know that we've always known that these things are possible to do, this sort of surveillance would be possible. Now we know that a government like the US is willing to do this. Will we ever be able to trust this?
Well, and let's be clear, not just the US. You can be sure that China, Russia, and many of the European allies are doing much the same. And some of this indignation, let's face it, is for domestic audiences here in Europe. It's not like the French and the Germans don't spy on others. But Obama said just yesterday that this is about spying is about ultimately making sure American people are safe. Now, you could argue that perhaps, given the mixture of peoples in France, that there is some need to comb through the cell phones of certain people within France about the possibility of terrorism. You could, maybe. But it's very hard to see how you can justify listening in on leaders and tapping their emails, whether it's Mexico, Brazil, and Spain now, I think, just was added to the list, as well as France and Germany.
Some 60 million phone calls allegedly in Spain.
You know, they're not actual phone calls. They're numbers that connected to numbers. They weren't listening to people's conversations, as I understand it. But still, I think the bigger issue here is who's watching the spies. And it sounds to me, and to many of us, like no one is.
Well, let's just stay with Obama, though. How does he recover from this politically very damaging situation?
He's going to have to give some ground. You know, there are right now, there's this interesting deal that goes back to the end of the Second World War called the Five Eyes. The U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, those five countries have an agreement that goes back to the 40s that says we will not spy on one another. There had been talk early, not so long ago, about France joining that group. That didn't happen. And France now says it's not interested. They're in a huff. But Germany is. And so that negotiation may happen, and that may well transpire.
It's another interesting facet of this is Glenn Greenwald, who has the Guardian journalist, who has been responsible for the link up, at least with Edward Snowden, and allowing some of these facts to come out, or these alleged facts, I should say. Glenn Greenwald has stirred the hornet's nest again now. Maybe Hornet's Nest is right in that it contains a lot of bugs.
In his comments to Germany.
Yeah, he's suggested that Germany should offer asylum
to
Snowden.
Well, he can suggest it all he wants. It's not going to happen. I mean, the bottom line is Merkel may be upset. The Germans are offended, but they're not going to give asylum to Snowden. I think, though, that many people are reassessing their views of what Snowden has done. I think one of the top Washington Post columnists had said not long after the Snowden affair arose that Snowden was a traitor and that this was horrendous behavior on his part by releasing all these secrets. And he has more recently recanted and said, you know, I spoke too hastily. Snowden has done us a favor.
Will we see long-term damage to the special relationship with the U.S. and European partners?
Well, is it just what's long term? You know, I think that, you know, all relationships have have to endure damage, don't they? And these
Indeed.
Are
mine and Phil's has gone through some torrid times.
There you go. Yeah, maybe we should talk about that.
We don't have enough time.
Listen. One of the things that I find so sobering about this is that the Orwellian state is with us. You know, I remember as a kid reading 1984 thinking, that is so far from reality. How scary. But, you know, it really is here, and this is confirmation.
Okay. Let's move on to another story, which has been covered fairly widely. We're looking at one article in Al Jazeera here, which is telling us about this enormous bank heist in Libya.
Well, Libya, you know, we've talked about this before. As you know, I covered the Libyan revolution for ABC News in 2011. In fact, it's just we're just past the 2-year anniversary of the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, October 20th, 2011. And this caught my eye just because it's yet another sobering reminder that it may be easy to win the revolution. It's not so easy to win the peace. A $55 million bank heist yesterday in the city of Sirte, which happens to be the city where Muammar Gaddafi was born. It's about halfway between Tripoli and Benghazi on the Mediterranean coast. Not a big city, but 80,000 people. Money coming from the central bank in Tripoli on a plane, going into an armored car, 10 men with heavily armed men surrounded, and they steal $55 million. You know, this is a rich country with lots of oil, except it's also incredibly poor. Oil production down, I think, this week to 10% because of strikes and a lot of strife. And it's just a mess there. And it's incredibly sad, but there's no resolution in sight.
And of course, back in 2011, Gaddafi freed many convicted convicts, criminals that were in Libya's jails, freed them onto the streets. And many of these individuals are now, you know, running gangs across the country. Is that a serious problem?
I'm sorry, I have to disagree with you. I don't think it's that. I think it's this issue of the armed militias. You know, there really wasn't, beyond his own personal army, there wasn't any governmental structure. And so what rose in the revolution were regional militias, kind of mafias under local commanders, and a staggering number of guns. My enduring memory of my time in Libya after the liberation, where everyone with an AK-47 firing it indiscriminately in the air, I found it terrifying. The problem is those guns are still there. And so a bunch of guys get together, whether this was organized on a high level or just 10 guys got together with their guns, we don't know. But the point is that it's really anarchy. It is the Wild West. This is a stagecoach robbery, really.
I want to briefly, before you go, Jeffrey, talk to you about pretty innovative governmental tactics in Venezuela.
Now, well, this caught my eye. Listen, we were just talking about Orwell. Orwell lives in Caracas. I mean, this is an incredible story. Everyone knew the name of the previous president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. I think Nicolas Maduro is not quite the worldwide household name, but if he continues like this, he might well be. He's a protege of Chavez, and you'll remember he just barely won. But he has announced that he is going to create a deputy ministry of supreme social happiness. Now, George Orwell would really like that one.
A happiness ministry. Brilliant.
It's the purpose of ensuring supreme social happiness. We'll look after disabled brothers and sisters, those who are homeless, old folks, children, etc. I mean, the earnestness of it all is incredible. The timing, however, is not, because it's an incredibly cynical move. There are municipal elections coming up, and it's a way to disperse social largesse in Venezuela. But how sad. Venezuela, staggeringly rich, like Libya, an oil state. You know, you've heard of the oil curse, and it very much lives on in these two countries. So much money and so little of it getting to the people. Well, Latin America just powers forward in Brazil, in Colombia, in Chile, in Peru. Venezuela, which should be one of those really strong countries, hobbled by just the staggeringly bad government and these kind of ridiculous programs. Now they have at times filtered down under Chavez. One of the things he did do was improve healthcare and education. But the country is just terribly, terribly poor on the street level.
Jeffrey, always good to talk to you. Jeffrey Kaufman is ABC's London correspondent and our own Minister of Happiness here at Monocle 24.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be asking whether the M23 rebel forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo are about to be defeated.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe. The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, for 18 months, the M23 rebel group has been the thorn in the side of the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The group, which is named after a 2009 peace accord they accuse the government of breaking, has destabilised vast chunks of the east of the country and soured relations with DRC's neighbours, especially Rwanda, which has covertly supported the rebels for years.
But today, the group is finished. Well, that's according to the UN Special Envoy in the DRC. Martin Kobler has said the rebels have abandoned military positions in the east and are now confined to a small patch near the Rwandan border. His announcement comes just a few weeks after peace talks hosted by the Ugandans broke down. So could the DRC really be heading for a period of stability? Well, today we're joined in the studio by Phil Clark, a lecturer in comparative and international politics at SOAS here in London. Welcome to the program. Phil, should we take heed with what Martin Kobler has said? Are the rebels nearly finished?
I think we should treat Kobler's comments with a certain degree of skepticism. We've heard the UN before claim that M23 have been completely wiped out. I think what's more likely at the moment is that the rebels have been confined in a small amount of territory in northeastern Congo. But I guess the possibility is that they could rearm, they could come back, as we've seen them do in the last year or so. So I don't think that this episode has yet come to an end.
What exactly do the M23 rebels want? Because we know why they set up. We know where their name comes from that anniversary. But what exactly have they been after?
It's a combination of factors that drives the M23. On the one hand, their leadership very much wants senior positions within the Congolese army, and they want to guarantee that they'll continue to have significant political and military influence within Congo. But M23 also represents some very important ethnic interests on the ground, particularly the interests of the Tutsi minority group. And I think M23's concerns is that if they are wiped out, that there really is no forceful mission left in eastern Congo to protect Tutsis. So M23 are very worried about that.
And of course, you mentioned the Tutsis, which are in power in Rwanda, a very key player in this conflict as well. What role are they playing? Obviously, many people alleging that they have been supporting the M23 rebels. They came out just a couple of days ago saying that if shelling continues along the border region, that they're not going to be able to stand by and watch it happen.
This is one of the real concerns in the region at the moment, namely that Rwanda might become much more militarily involved. Rwanda will be very concerned that it could lose an ally in M23 this week. One of the concerns, I guess, is that if Rwanda feels that its interests in eastern Congo are being challenged, that they may seek to go back across the border and try and regain what they've lost through M23. I think one of the other factors here, and we're not hearing much from the UN on this at the moment, is that the UN mission has always had a dual mandate. One was to target the M23 rebel group, but the other part was to target the FDLR, which is a Hutu-dominated rebel force that's been wreaking havoc in this part of Congo for the last decade. And we haven't yet seen any moves by the UN to target this Hutu group. And that's one of the things that could also drive Rwanda back into Congo. It is a sense that the UN may renege on its promise to also target FDLR. So it remains to be seen what happens on that front.
So what's the progress then at this point? We know that there were these talks with Uganda as the mediators, effectively in the last couple of weeks. They're sort of on pause. What do you think happens now?
In many ways, this situation is fundamentally stalled. I don't think that we're seeing a great degree of progress in resolving the conflict, even if M23 is neutralized this week. And I think it's because there are much deeper issues here. And one of the tensions in this whole situation has been that, on the one hand, the UN was saying it was supporting peace talks in Kampala. But on the other hand, it was also pursuing this military option against M23. And I always thought that there was a fundamental contradiction there. On the one hand, asking M23 to negotiate and Rwanda and other regional players to negotiate, but the UN simultaneously was targeting M23 militarily. So it calls into question just how serious the UN really was about these peace talks. The more important issue at the moment is that there's not going to be long-term peace and stability in eastern Congo until there's fundamental political reform within President Kabila's government in Kinshasa. And unfortunately, I think there's so much emphasis on the military solution at the moment that those deeper issues of political reform and the dysfunctionality of the Congolese state won't be dealt with, in which case we're going to see the same kind of conflict perpetuate as we have in the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, I am going to play the optimist when it comes to these peace talks. There were 11 issues that they were discussing or negotiating on in Kampala. They supposedly had reached agreement on 8 of the 11 issues. Still outstanding are consensus on amnesty, integration, security, and things like that. So there is a bit of hope there, isn't there?
It's true that some of these issues were resolved, but I think the three outstanding issues were always the key ones, and they were the ones that the M23 rebels were hinging any kind of peace deal on. That the issue of amnesty continues, and the international community takes a very hard line against amnesty for serious perpetrators of crimes. Unfortunately, I think that that's a hard line attitude that meant that those peace talks really had very little chance of succeeding. So I think we need to see much more flexibility on the amnesty issue. I think we may have to bite the bullet and see the integration of some of these rebel leaders back into the Congolese army. That's not an ideal solution, but perhaps the only way forward at the moment.
Phil, excellent stuff. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Phil Clark, lecturer in comparative and international politics at SOAS in London. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And it's 12:24 in Moscow, 9:24 in Paris, 8:24 a.m. here in London. Time then to catch up with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're going to discuss the latest news out of Norway. Our expert in that particular part of the world is Lars Bevanger. Lars, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you very much.
Good Excellent. Morning. Nice to have you with us again. So first on your agenda today, an unusual story about a pair of sisters from Oslo. Tell us.
Yes. These are two sisters, 16 and 19-year-old, who 1.5 weeks ago suddenly disappeared from home, only for their parents to discover they've left a note saying they were heading to Syria to help fellow Muslims there. Now, these two girls come from a Norwegian-Somali background, and understandably, their father became very, very worried for their safety heading into a potential war situation. And he's now left to go looking for them, and we understand that he's now on the border between Turkey and Syria looking for them. And this worries both police and the girl's father's lawyer. They're now all worried about the safety for both the girls and the father who's gone looking for them.
And of course, Lars, this is playing a particularly significant now because there are reports, of course, that a Norwegian citizen of Somali descent took part in those horrible terror attacks in Nairobi at the Westgate shopping mall. How is that playing out?
Well, there's no suggestion of any link to illegal activities with these two girls who've gone down heading to Syria. They've said that they want to help fellow Muslims in what they see as a humanitarian catastrophe. But of course, it does throw even more light on the Norwegian-Somali community in Oslo and beyond in Norway. There was one of the suspected militants at the Westgate shopping mall terror attack, which Norwegian secret police is investigating to see whether he was involved in the planning and the execution there. So the Somali community in Oslo have definitely felt the pressure now from police investigators in Norway and from Kenya to look at whether there's any kind of recruitment going on from abroad of Norwegian Somalis in Norway.
Lars, I want to talk about another story which is making the headlines with you, and that's proposed changes to the way GPs deal with the issue of abortion in Norway.
Yeah, that's right. Up until now, GPs have had no right to deny a woman a referral to have an abortion if she came to see him or her for that help. Of course, Norway is renowned for being at the forefront of gender equality and women's liberation. But Norway's just had a new government just a few weeks ago, a centre-right government led by the Conservative Party. And as part of their negotiations to form a government, they agreed with another centre-right party, the Christian Democrats, that they would support the coalition government in Parliament only if they agreed to reintroduce the GP's right to deny a woman the right to have a referral to an abortion. There are a few GPs in Norway, particularly on religious grounds, who will not feel comfortable to pass on a patient to have an abortion. Now, this is causing quite a stir in Norway, as you might imagine, in a very liberal society as it is. And there doesn't seem to be much popular support for this move. But, of course, there is parliamentary majority to pass this legislation.
Lars, let's stick with Norway's new government, Prime Minister Erna Solberg. A bit of a controversy, though, when it comes to the new government potentially being a bit too close when it comes to the PR industry.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of toing and froing between the PR industry and government and parliament recently. There's quite a few ex-politicians who have gone to work in marketing and PR, but the problem arises, it seems, when it goes the other way. One of the new government ministers, the Minister of Agriculture and Food, has come straight out of a PR job in one of the major PR firms in Norway. Now, it emerges that her firm, among their clients were some of Norway's major supermarket chains. Now, of course, being Minister for Food, she'll be in charge of supermarkets as well, as it were. So the pressure is now on her to publicise all her clients' from her PR firm? Who did she advise? Who and how close a relationship does she have to these interests, which might now turn out to be vested interests? Can she be seen to be impartial in cases of if she was representing any other food industries or agricultural machinery manufacturers, things like this? So she doesn't want to disclose her public customer list, and other PR firms say, well, this is confidential information. We don't want to give up any information that we don't have to give up. But there's building pressure now for this to happen, to see whether she's got any vested interests.
Lars, I feel thoroughly updated on the stories people in Norway are talking about. Lars Bevanger, our man who is most knowledgeable on issues of Norwegian news. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we will find out how Mexico's Day of the Dead has influenced the arts in the country. And we head to the Netherlands to meet the chief design officer for Philips Lighting.
We want to be a people's company. We want to do healthcare. We want to make simple solutions that enrich your life. Or that sounds like marketing babble, but it is for real.
But first, Barney Burnham's here with your news headlines.
Thanks, Don. The White House has acknowledged the need for greater constraints on U.S. intelligence services following the latest claim to surveillance of its allies. President Obama has confirmed that he's ordered a complete review of intelligence operations outside the U.S. At least 13 people have died in a storm which has battered northwestern Europe. Six of the deaths were in Germany. Four people also died in southern England. Record gusts of 119 miles an hour recorded on the North Sea. Chinese police have named two suspects they believe are linked to Monday's incident in which five people died when a car ploughed into a group of people in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. The suspects come from a province which is home to a minority Muslim group. James Comey has been installed as new director of the FBI. He replaces Robert Mueller, who's led the bureau since shortly before the September 11, 2001 attacks. Protesters have gone on the rampage in Sao Paulo after a teenager was shot dead by police on Sunday. Local stores were looted and ransacked. Traffic was blocked for hours after two trucks and at least five buses were torched on a buses were torched on a major road. The Chinese piano virtuoso Lang Lang has become the 12th United Nations Messenger of Peace, joining celebrities such as Stevie Wonder, Michael Douglas, Edward Norton and Charlize Theron. Messengers of Peace are celebrities mainly from the fields of film, music, literature and sport who promote UN activities and ideals through public appearances and media contacts. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Mr. Phil Hahn. This week on Section D, we have a selection of reports from Dutch Design Week in Eindhoven. And in this preview of the programme, we're acknowledging the city's technological past. Philips grew from a father-son company to the global tech powerhouse, familiar to anyone with a TV, radio or a shaver. And with the success of its original creation, the incandescent lamp in 1891, Philips transformed Eindhoven forever, at one point employing over 90,000 workers across its factories and research departments.
But with the potential for Western companies to manufacture its products in the Far East, the world changed. The heart of this southern Dutch city skipped a beat, while the identity change from factory town to knowledge town formed much of my discussion, well, much of Alad John's discussion with Roger van der Heijder, chief design officer for Philips Lighting. He told Alad that Philips, despite a rather muted presence at Dutch Design Week, is very much involved in the design community across the Netherlands.
Over 120 years of innovation shows Philips's commitment to improving people's lives. Everything started with light.
The lighting industry is in transformation. It is making this shift from lamps and bulbs and, let's say, analog lighting to digital lighting. We've heard a lot about it now. And Philips is the largest company in lighting, so we are supposed to lead that transformation. So for a designer, that should be a very exciting time to be part of that change and to drive it with products that really tap into the sort of unknown qualities of light or the undiscovered qualities of light that now have become more accessible and more feasible with LED.
Let's talk about some of the Philips products that are featuring at Dutch Design Week. You have some collaborations here. Can you tell me a little bit about what work Philips is doing with the designers and what one can go and see should they care to?
Okay, well, here at the Design Week, I think very interesting is our collaboration with Pauline van Dongen. She is a fashion designer and she focuses on technology in fashion. She integrates technology with garments and not just stitching buttons to control your iPod on a sleeve of a jacket, but she does really integrated stuff. For example, she is developing garments that include illumination, but this illumination, you don't look into it, it shines onto the fabric and then reflects, so it becomes incredibly sophisticated and gentle. And I think it takes a fashion designer to explore that. So that makes Philips in the collaboration really an enabler, because the fashion designer has a dream. And our technologies in the field of integration of fabrics and light make that dream become real. So we do, I think, very exciting things with the same technology, but we use it mostly in medical applications. For example, we produced a blanket, and this blanket gives a very special light that helps small babies to activate their metabolism. Maybe you know that some babies, they turn yellow right after the birth, and then they need light therapy. So you can put them under a big lampshade with bright white light. But it's very uncomfortable and it's very unpleasant and it's not really convenient for the nurse. And the mom and dad have to leave the baby in the hospital. But we put that same light in a blanket and you can wrap a fluffy plush blanket around the baby and the baby gets light therapy. And I think that's so sweet, you know, and so much in the heart of what we want to be as Philips. We want to be a people's company. We want to do healthcare. We want to make simple solutions that enrich your life. Or that sounds like marketing babble, but it is for real. So when we could team up with Pauline van Dongen, the fashion designer, I thought it's great because this same technology that cures the baby now finds its way into fashion.
75 verkondigden de ramen van het hoofdkantoor van Philips. Fabrieken en kantoren stroomden leeg en massa's feestvierders vulden Eindhoven's straten en vormden optochten met portretten van Dr. Anton Philips en de huidige president-directeur Frits Philips.
Eindhoven is the home of Philips, and Philips is omnipresent in certain ways, but it's quite a restrained presence here, considering it the legacy of the company in the town. Could you perhaps paint a picture for us of how important Philips is, or was, for Eindhoven, and where the company is now, concerning its design presence in contemporary Dutch design?
Myself, I am on the Philips leadership. We still feel very fond of Eindhoven, and even though, yes, it is our home, but Shanghai has become our second home, you know. China is our home country. Not only for manufacturing, certainly not. We have, I believe, 1,500 scientists and researchers and designers working in Shanghai on our campus there. It's a huge market for us, obviously. But if I go back to Eindhoven, this was once the place where all our factories were and, you know, where the big inventions were done. There was a world-class laboratory. But some of that is still here. And although manufacturing doesn't really take place here, a few exceptions, but almost not, this is still a place where we invest big time in research. You know, we want this to be our number one research center in the world. And we attract that way scientists of the very top level. We collaborate with the technical university. We have opened up the campus for all kinds of other companies, from startups to really established high-tech companies, chemical, whatever. They have their labs, their research. It's a community, and Eindhoven, I think they have played a very smart game. They say, well, look, Holland is a small country. We have the airport, which provides about 100,000 jobs near Amsterdam. Then we have Rotterdam, the port. Rotterdam calls themselves the main port, right? There is the airport, the main port. And then Eindhoven said, well, we are the brain port. So brain port became not just a buzzword, but a concept that we really all have in our minds and understand and that we kind of try to live up to. And Brainport is Eindhoven as a city where knowledge is created and commercialized and shared and cultivated. And the university is a big player in there. The Design Academy is a big player in there. The city, because they foster all of that. And Philips, as one of the main drivers and still having thousands of people employed in Eindhoven, but now not anymore in factories, but really in, you know, strategy. Research, design. Our biggest design studio is here.
With the move of much of the resource team in Philips to the Far East, has Eindhoven had to then go and undergo a kind of identity change to an extent?
I think you're right. And they've done so well. I mean, it is a really impressive case study, I think. I mean, there is Strijp, and you were just there. Strijp is a factory complex. It's not the biggest factory complex you've ever seen, but it is sizable, you know. It's a lot of historic buildings. They were all empty. And look what is happening there now. I mean, I don't mean the Dutch Design Week. I mean, all year round, people are living there. People are working there. People have their play there, you know, their leisure. There's innovation companies, design studios. It's a very, very lively environment. It's well connected to the city center. It's actually just a brief walk, but there's a fast shuttle. It's all very thoughtful, and it works. If Eindhoven would not have done that, and instead just feel, you know, self-pity when Philips decided to go, I don't think it would have been much good, you know. And now it is a place where people enjoy living, and where you can go really for the best education in design and technology. So I'm really impressed. And I think indeed, as you say, the city did reinvent itself, you know. It has a different identity now. It was a factory town. It's a knowledge city now. I think in 2012 or 11, it was voted the smartest region in the world or something like that. It topped Silicon Valley, you know. That's quite impressive. And I think the city should be proud of that, you know.
And that was Roger van der Heide speaking to Monocle's Alla John for this week's Dutch Design Week special edition of Section D. And of course, you can catch the full interview when the show premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
Yes, you can. You are listening to Midori House. After this, we dive into the world of Mexican horror. Stay tuned if you dare.
With nothing more than excellence in mind, Monocle scoured the globe for the most irresistible brands, retailers, artisans, and manufacturers. Our selection highlights the very best.
A decade after jeans manufacturer Dewhurst closed its base in Wales, entrepreneur David Hyatt decided to bring denim production back to the Tevi estuary. The town's heritage means its seasoned staff share over 200 years of industry experience.
Trader's secrets revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, where the time in London is 8:42 a.m.
We dare not show you the rest of this scene. It is too shocking to watch.
Confusingly, that is the English version of a Spanish trailer.
I'm scared, though.
It was advertising Misterios de Ultratumba, or in the English version, the title was The Black Pit of Dr. M. It's a 1959 film, and it's by Fernando Mendez. Now, we're playing it to you because, forget Halloween, it's time for Mexican horror. El Día de los Muertos, the Mexican Day of the Dead, will take place on the first 2 days of December. And here in London, the British Film Institute and the Latin American agency Movimentos have decided to mark the event with a special Day of the Dead experience.
Well, the festivities should actually begin on the 1st and 2nd of November.
I thought they did. It's some sort of gremlins in the machine here.
Well, they include Mexican horror films, undead DJs, and immersive theater performances. But beyond all that, the experience will highlight the very rich folklore around the Day of the Dead in Mexico. And to discuss this further, we're lucky to say we're joined in this studio with Sofia Descalon, who's in charge of the film program, and Callum Simpson, who's curated the live acts. Well, welcome to the program, both of you. It's fast coming, November 1st and 2nd, the Day of the Dead experience. Give us a sense of what we might expect.
Right, well, it takes its cue from the Gothic season, which the BFI have instigated, which is celebrating all kinds of horror films and that sense of gothic in cinema, and it's kind of an event as part of that season, but we decided to show something a little bit different because this is quite a rare Mexican film, and obviously it's not very well known, so
I have
it's actually
to say
a classic.
Hadn't heard of it.
Well, yeah,
but
it's not known here.
Yeah, so Fernando Mendez was one of he kind of Mexican cinema in the 50s started to kind of take on move towards horror. And originally it was kind of based around wrestling. So wrestling in Mexico is like a really big thing. And there is a whole genre of Mexican wrestling horror films where they kind of fight zombies. Fight Aztec mummies and all these things. And he had a film called The Monster Resurrected, which was about a monster who has a man who has a brain transplant from a gorilla. And that was kind of a wrestling film with a brain transplant in the middle. And
obviously.
Which
it's
was
quite
kind
hard
of
to pitch that one in an elevator, isn't it?
But from there, he did a film called The Vampire, which was kind of like a worldwide sensation and put Mexican horror films on the map. And then he did The Coffin of the Vampire. And then he did this film, which is A Black Pit of Dr. M, which is beautifully photographed, eerie, kind of zombie film with, you know, a sexy girl in it as well, and like two mad doctors and a crazy woman in a lunatic asylum. So you get every kind of, you know, symbol of horror films in there, which is great, which is so much fun.
Well, you say sort of, you know, sexy girls and mad doctors and all of this dark stuff. And that sounds to me like classic sort of 50s Hammer horror. What's the Mexican flavour that's in here?
I guess it's a lot of the time they take elements of their own culture. So having the Lucha Libre films, we're actually going to do a little montage of Lucha Libre clips as well. So we're going to have, Santo was like the classic mask. So they always wear masks. So you don't actually see any of the actors' faces. They always wear masks. So Santo and Blue Demon. And there's one film which is Santo Against the Martians. So you have all these Martians in like lots of glittery costumes. And obviously girls are scantily clad and they come down. And then there's lots of wrestling scenes. And, you know, it's all very camped up and kind of fun. But that's the great thing. It's kind of Day of the Dead is a celebration of the dead. And this is like celebrating it. It's not actually kind of saying, oh, let's...
It's fun rather than
being
morbid.
It's fun, it's joyful, absolutely. And that's the point. That's what we wanted to get across with this weekend.
Callum,
well,
you're in charge of, I guess, curating the live acts that are going to be there in the next couple of days. I'm just reading some of the notes here, and absolutely fantastic. You can dance the night away with roaming zombies. Apparently there's a high priestess. Give us a sense of some of these acts.
Well, the idea with the, you know, to put the film in kind of in a different kind of context, really, was to bring in performers and dancers as well. So we've got special kind of dance rituals that are going to happen, punctuate the night in between the live acts. So, and some of the live acts will be also quite immersive, sort of acoustic walkabout as well.
So if people are hoping to sort of turn up and sort of anonymously sit in the corner and observe quietly by themselves, that's not going to work.
We've
got face painters, so they've got to get their face painted at the very least, you know. We're encouraging people to come in fancy dress though, so, you know.
But the main band, the headline band, actually take their reference from the Day of the Dead, which is why they're sort of perfect band, because they play sort of big band Latin American brass music and also some New Orleans stuff and Afrobeat. But they all normally, anyway, they would wear Day of the Dead face paint. Mm. So it just sort of shows how far it's the kind of Day of the Dead theme has permeated our
culture. How important do you think these kind of immersive experiences are when it comes to film? Because there's like, it seems like it's a bit of a, you know, a thing these days. You go to the secret cinema, you dress up and you're kind of surrounded as if you were in the film. How important are those kind of immersive experiences?
I think they're really important, actually, because they give people a different experience of cinema. And, you know, we're moving away from just going to the multiplex or just going and sitting in front of the screen, and people actually, you know, getting involved, knowing more about the culture, which this event is hopefully going to, you know, expand people's knowledge, but actually interact directly with the film and with the event. And I think that's brilliant. And, you know, it kind of, you go out with your friends and you have a good time and you talk about it. And it's just, it's looking at film in a different way. And it's making it exciting and relevant again, I think.
I mean, I guess one question mark that might be lingering in people's minds is people maybe and probably will be familiar with Halloween and the sort of cultural associations of that. The Day of the Dead presumably has the same sort of religious root back in the day. How does it differ and what are the similarities?
I think the main difference is Halloween. Halloween has its roots in the end of the harvest season. It's a pagan celebration originally. And Day of the Dead is very much based in Latin America. But I think the main difference is the way that each one is celebrated. And Halloween is very much about evil monsters and kind of the dark side, the evil side. Whereas Day of the Dead is people actually come together, families come together. They celebrate their loved ones. They remember them in a joyful, peaceful way.
And there's always a shrine. So you have a shrine that's, you bring an offering for a lost loved one or a bunch of flowers. And so people bring fruit and anything from beer to all kinds of artifacts to place on the shrine.
So it's a slightly different approach to death.
It's an uplifting one, yeah. Death, it's a celebration, yeah.
Okay, well, Sofia de Scallon and Callum Simpson, both curators of the Dia de los Muertos experience, remind us when and where we can see it, Sofia.
So it's the 1st and 2nd of November at Rich Mix, and the 1st of November we're actually doing a late night screening of Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone, which is a classic.
Excellent.
And then the Saturday, we're kicking off at 7 o'clock with The Black Pit of Dr. M.
Wonderful. Guys, and thank you very much indeed for coming in and joining us. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for coming
so
in.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, we're about to have a leaf through this morning's British front pages, but first, let's get some Mexican music, shall we? This is the singer Julieta Venegas with Eres Para Mí.
Julieta Venegas there with Eres Para Mí.
I like your accent.
Thank you very much.
Just put on a bit of a
sounds like you did not like my accent.
Didn't know you were bilingual, Dom.
No, I'm not. I can speak any language provided it's in English and I can put on the accent. It's a real,
it's the English way,
skill.
Isn't it? It's traditional English way, right?
That's
there.
It, or add O to the end of words. You are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn. And it's time to flick through the newspapers. The voice you heard there, the disembodied voice, was that of Tom Lewis, of course. Tom.
Good morning, Dom. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Tom.
Welcome. How are we?
Very well.
We're okay. We're excited because you've told us there's a secret story you're going to talk to us about.
There's a surprise. I always like to sort of, you know, keep some things at my sleeve.
Okay. You're a sneaky one, aren't you?
I hope you won't be disappointed today.
Never disappointed by you, Tom.
Sleeves.
You always impressed.
Thank you.
Always.
Okay, well, we'll wait to see what's up your worrying sleeve later on. But why don't we start with, we want to talk about the storm.
Yes, I'm glad to see both survived the storm.
Yes, just about. Got an inside-out umbrella at home.
Well,
testify.
You've gone off lightly then, therefore.
Just about.
I mean, lots of the papers today are covering the storm. There's an incredible photo on the front of the Daily Telegraph, which shows one of these houses, probably the most dramatic photo from the storm.
Mm.
A tree fell, and they think that caused a gas explosion, which tore these suburban houses apart. Obviously, this has now become a European story. Mm. The storm has made its way across Germany, where 6 people are believed to have died, I believe. And in Amsterdam, too, I believe a woman was killed as a tree fell along one of the canals there. So obviously this was the only story people in the UK were talking about yesterday.
Across Europe, is there generally a sense that people were well prepared, informed of what was coming? Well, it didn't come too much as a shock across the continent.
I mean, it's interesting. Some of the coverage in the British papers today is doing that traditional British thing of saying, well, actually, did everyone go a bit bonkers? Did everyone go over-prepared? Did everyone sort of worry people too much about this? Especially when you look at the train lines and the transport infrastructure here. There was, lots of aircraft were grounded yesterday. The trains were stopped. Lots of lines were, covered by trees and things. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's a sort of you're damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing.
Is absolutely the truth of the matter. Either way,
and actually, you look at the disruption. I think most people who are, say, stuck on London's transport network yesterday would actually say that was kind of a small price to pay, because some of the stories of the small handful of people, thankfully, that suffered very badly in the storm yesterday, actually that's really doesn't compare to those stories that we'll be learning more about over the next couple of days.
Thomas, another story, of course, today kicks off the first day of the World Islamic Economic Forum here in Lima. Very important event, but coincides with another bit of Islamic-related news, I guess.
Yes, so George Osborne, the Chancellor here in the UK, is is going to launch an Islamic bond plan here in the City of London. The Financial Times has this on its front page, so it's going quite big on this. Basically, George Osborne wants to make it an Islamic finance-friendly centre. The Islamic finance industry is worth about $1 trillion, I believe, every year. Now, obviously, in Islam, it prohibits interest. So basically, it's sukuk, as it's called, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You've discussed this already this morning, I believe, so do correct me if I'm wrong.
Carry on.
Basically, so it allows Islamic investors or investors in this Islamic system to make money off the underlying asset. So you're
not
kind of making
right.
money that you didn't sort of earn yourself effectively. Now, I mean, the Financial Times' slant on this is saying that this is actually a moment where the global financial crisis, that the British government particularly, is really trying to draw a line under it. Obviously, George Osborne was in China last week, I believe, or a couple of weeks ago, trying to push for Chinese banks to come and invest more in London. So, you know, you're looking at these new ways that the government is trying to rebuild the city as a global financial hub once again.
It certainly is. I'm worried that your bulging sleeve is not going to be revealed.
Give it to us.
Let's
surprise
go.
Story.
Okay, so did you ever watch a TV series called The Killing?
I have seen that, yes.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, tonight, debuting on TV screens across the nation is the Welsh version of The Killing.
The Killing.
It's a series called Y Gwaith, Hinterland. It was filmed in three languages, in Welsh, in English, and one version with both languages.
Oh, thank goodness.
It's having quite some hype. The Times is going big on it today.
Right.
And you should tune in later and see if it'll capture the imagination as much as Denmark's The Killing did.
Save a seat next to you on the couch.
Fantastic.
Look
forward to it.
A bowl of popcorn.
I'll keep it warm for you.
Thanks very much, Tom. Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer Daphne Denny, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Thorpe, and of course our studio manager Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs. I'll be back with Marcus Hippie for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.